Okay, we want to go ahead and begin. We welcome all of you to this Central Region meeting. We're grateful, thankful for all the board members. We want to recognize Director Sheehan with us and all the division personnel. And we're really thankful that Amanda's here. So, we want to go over a little bit of the, well, first let's introduce the RAC. Okay, we'll start over here with Jake.
Jacob Steele, I represent the Goshute Tribe.
Alan White, I represent agriculture.
Chris Marble, Sportsman's at Large.
Carl Burr, Sportsman.
Larry Fitzgerald, agriculture.
I'm Mike Gates, I'm with the BLM.
Oh, Dan Potts, non-consumptive.
Ben Mutter, at large.
Matt Clark, Sportsman's Rep.
Ron Camp, Sportsman's Rep.
Ken Strong, Sportsman's Rep.
I'm Richard Hanson, the RAC Chair. I'd like to explain a little bit about the procedures tonight and what will happen so we keep this orderly. It's a public forum that allows you to express your opinions and ideas, and we encourage you to do this. What the RAC decides here is then taken to the Wildlife Board, and they use that in their considerations of the different points in motion. And we all have our own ideas about what should happen and what shouldn't happen, and we ask all of you to just be respectful of each other's opinions and try to do this in an orderly way. On the chair, there's a comment card. We'd like you to fill those out if you'd like to comment on these action items tonight. The division will make a presentation that usually can last 10 to 15 minutes, and after that, then the RAC will have an opportunity to ask questions or clarifications of the presentation. Once that happens, then you'll have the opportunity to ask questions about the presentation, and just remember that it's a question period at that point. Once everybody has had their opportunity to address the RAC, the question period will be closed, and then we'll open the opinions, and you can ask and you can state your opinions and any proposals that you might like to see have happen. If you represent an organization, you have 5 minutes. If you represent yourself, you'll be given 3 minutes. After all the public comment has been received, we'll close that comment period and allow the council to deliberate and make motions and vote on the subject. We just always want to remind you to be respectful and be able to, for everyone to express their views. Okay, we would like to turn to the Dr. Fairchild, and he'll give us an update. First, we need to have an approval of the agenda and the minutes of the last round.
I'll make a motion to approve the agenda and minutes.
Okay, Matt, second. Second by Ken. All in favor? Okay, any opposed? Okay, vote's unanimous. One abstention. Okay, with that, then let's turn the time over to Dr. Fairchild.
Okay, what I'll do is go through and give an update of activities in each of our sections. And since this is a RAC meeting focused on aquatics, I'm going to start there. And Mike, if you need to add in anything to spice this up a little bit, feel free. Lots going on in aquatics, as you all know. We've got a Jordanelle Fisheries Management Planning effort that's going to kick off on the 6th of October. Looking forward to that. That same day, we will be gill netting at Jordanelle, so the group that shows up there will get a firsthand appreciation for what kind of fish are in the reservoir. That same week, they'll also be doing a gillnet survey at Deer Creek. So I think that's the 6th and the 7th that those will be taking place. Big project that's phase three of the Mill Creek restoration work that's being done in conjunction with the Forest Service and a lot of other partners, TU and even Boy Scouts. That'll take place on the 15th of September. And this phase is it's going to be a retreatment of the middle section and the first treatment of the lower third. And in October, we'll be moving some Bonneville cutthroat trout into the middle section. Is that correct, Mike? So one more year of this, and then we'll have the entire drainage reestablished with Bonneville cutthroat trout. So kudos to Mike for a huge project and the Forest Service. And we welcome volunteers on that, and I think most of them have already been lined up, but everyone is welcome to show. At Jordanelle, there's also a food web study in progress, and this is a Blue Ribbon funded project, fish collection and stable isotope analysis, and I believe that's being done by USU, correct?
BYU.
Okay, well, we'll give credit to the Southern University there. Strawberry Kokanee Festival kicks off on the 19th of September, Saturday. It's always fun. Yuba Creel Survey concludes in December, and fishing is expected to pick up for pike in October and November on that reservoir, and which is very low right now, so if you're down there, you can expect low water levels. Community fisheries are getting stocked with rainbows again as the waters cool off. And we'll have our native aquatics will be sampling for leatherside chub this fall, electrofishing streams. At Utah Lake, the record of decision was signed by the Mitigation Commission Executive Director and Assistant Secretary of Interior in May of 2015 for the Provo River Delta Restoration Project. Major effort to establish an area conducive to reproduction of June sucker, fry, and the alternative that was selected was kind of a compromise. I guess there'll be an opportunity to expand the area that's acquired, but a limited area that large enough, you know, to establish a delta has been identified, and they'll also leave water in the river for those who recreate. You can go online and find out just what alternative B and option 2 actually are. Pending funding, the project is expected to take up to 5 years to complete. Carp removal continues. There's an indication that removal is starting to have a significant effect on the population. The average carp size is increasing, and numbers are slightly down. Pike is still a concern at Utah Lake, so lots of conservation activity going on there. In wildlife, several cities are planning to take advantage of the new urban deer control administrative rule, which allows cities to have a significant role in the management of deer within city limits. Elk management plan is going to go before the Wildlife Board in November. I had the opportunity to facilitate that. We had a great group, all dedicated to coming up with solutions for maintaining, you know, what we have, as opposed to the first plan was primarily how do we get to 80,000 elk. We're there, so now how do we deal with 80,000 elk is the challenge before this group. Rocky Mountain goat aerial surveys in August show that numbers are stable on Tippecanoe and the Cascade ranges and up on Lone Peak and Nebo. We'll be getting 10 mountain goats from Willard Peak that'll be released on the Box Elder Peak, and those will come with satellite collars. Elk classification on the Wasatch West was average. There's a lot of interest in that unit, given the fact that we're over objective and trying to come up with strategies to address that. But 58 calves per 100 cows is fairly high, but average for that unit. Forest grouse, both dusky and rough grouse, numbers are up. Good time to go forest grouse hunting. And also cottontail, snowshoe hare numbers are up. So that's a cyclical thing for cottontail and snowshoe. So if you, I hear it's best out in the basin, out on the Green River. So that would be a good place to go. What else? We've got deer removal operations in Heber that took place in an ag situation there in Center Creek, and also having to remove elk out of cornfields in Nephi. So the work of trying to strike a balance between what the sportsmen want to have and what the landowners can tolerate continues, and there are times when we have to play a role, and it's not possible for the public to remove those animals because they come in the dark. So fortunately we don't have a lot of that, but those are two areas where it's pretty significant. In our habitat section, we've got quite a few projects that are going to be taking place. We've got a 1,000-acre treatment, Spanish Fork Canyon. That's a bull hog treatment. In Sheep Creek and a lop and scatter in project in Mill Creek. Dog Valley, there's a PJ chaining on private land. We have chaining and bull hog treatments in the Vernon area, and that's primarily to benefit sage grouse in the sage grouse management area there. Also, fuels reduction project on the Santaquin WMA in partnership with the Forest Service. Upland game guzzlers were installed with the help of the Utah Chucker and Wildlife Foundation on our West Hills unit of Santaquin WMA. I mentioned in our outreach, I mentioned the Kokanee Festival on the 19th. We do have a DWR Central Facebook page, so I recommend that you check that out to see what else comes along. In our law enforcement, we've concluded our work at the point of entry for aquatic invasive species. I believe Candace has taken that station down. Is that correct, Mike? But our officers are going to be distributed around reservoirs, trying to get at least 2 hours in a week of just checking, following up and checking boaters, for compliance with our AIS regulations. But that is about it. If there are any questions from the RAC, I'll entertain them.
I have one. I saw in the news the other day of some type of a chemical that can be used to treat waters that will keep quagga mussel out of any water. Is that true? Some kind of a
silver bullet?
Yeah. That's how they presented it.
It can be applied in all circumstances to remove that.
Yeah, I mean, they were even talking like Lake Powell. I thought, holy cow, this is...
That's the manufacturer.
That's the manufacturer. Okay. Thank you.
Theoretically.
Talk about those.
If you train them.
Okay, we'll just go over some of the points of for the Wildlife Board. Their last meeting on some of the things that took place there, and kind of relate them to what we as a RAC did on these items. Under the Cougar Management Plan, that was approved by the board. There's a lot of discussion about that, but we also approved that, and the board eventually voted on that and approved that Cougar Management Plan. The Cougar Recommendations and Rule Amendments for 2015-16, where we were concerned, that was approved, but with these we actually had voted as a board to not make the West Nebo and Nebo a limited entry only and keep it a split unit. The board approved it as a to keep it in status as it is with a, as a split unit. And also they approved, we wanted 30 tags for the Book Cliffs. We voted for that. And I believe the board approved 29 tags on that unit, so I recall. So I, one of the reasons I mention that is because I think you need to understand that, that the Wildlife Board really listens to the RACs, especially for the areas that they that we represent. And they are really concerned. John Baer made a point of that, that the RACs and how they vote and what they say has a great deal of weight on the decisions that, that he believes that the board should take in the actions. So the fur bear and bobcat harvest recommendations, Leslie McFarland made that presentation also, and it went as we recommended. All the RACs approved that. The AIS rule amendments concerning the boat cleaning passed unanimously. The youth fishing exemption rules amendments passed, as we also agreed with that. The self-defense clarification against animals rule amendment was approved and passed by the board, as we did. Possession of firearms rule amendments, that's concerning the use of firearms on waterfowl and upland game areas. That passed also, as it was presented. The if you remember the five-day falconry meet request, they presented to our RAC, and we approved that. The board also approved that. And then the fee proposal. Okay. the fee proposal that was presented by that the board was passed. Red Fleet Management was management plan was also passed. I guess we're going to do a rotenone treatment on that. The expo permit audit, the expo permit allocation, the conservation permit allocation 1 and 3 years, and the certification review committee recommendations were all passed by the board. So, any questions from the board?
All I recall is that the timetable for Red Fleet has been changed because of the increase in volume, you know, with the in the reservoir, and there are you're still challenged to find that much rotenone. Is that still the case, or
we just found out today that the rotenone will be available and that it's on for the 13th of October, so we feel really good about that, not having to postpone.
Okay, this group probably is interested in that. That's why I brought it up. So,
hey,
here, I've done my deal. Why don't you sit right here, and I'll go get a chair. Well, can I just...
Chris Schmitz, non-consumptive wildlife.
Okay, let's move on. We'll have a presentation by the division concerning the fishing guidebook and rule. Drew Cushing and Paul Bergey will do that. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hard to believe another year's gone by. I just wanted to, you know, acknowledge all the Division of Wildlife folks. Most importantly, Mike Slater, the regional manager, and Paul Bergey, and Roger Wilson. This is a fairly simple year this year, and I think you guys have seen it. So I would like to really acknowledge the public. This is quite a few folks here, and let them know that this is important that they attend these meetings. This is their opportunity to weigh in and voice their opinion to those that matter, mostly yourself. So I'll get going. So several years ago, we stopped doing the informational rack tour. We just didn't get the participation from the public, and so we sought a better way to receive feedback from the public without going out and attending the, you know, the racks in the spring. So we put together an online survey. This year we did this survey, and once again to gather information on proposed regulation changes, but then also to just gauge and ask them questions about, you know, their feelings, whether they have any issues, and what might be on their mind. The survey ran about 8 weeks again this year. We had an all-time high of folks that responded to the survey, 1,800, and so it was a really good response. This survey provided us really good input on the regulation changes that we're going to recommend we move forward with, but it also provided us input, which we forwarded to our regional staffs, to just let them know that these are issues with the public and they might want to address them in the future. So one of the questions was on tiger muskie management, and we asked this question because we reached a point in our internal muskie production where we feel confident that we can achieve, you know, good survival and be able to stock our tiger muskie waters with regularity and consistency. So we wanted to gauge what the public felt about the future tiger muskie management in Utah. 41% of the anglers who we surveyed target tiger muskie, which is much higher than what we thought. We thought there, you know, a minority of anglers that target them, but roughly half of the people that were surveyed fished for them, or just under half. And most of the anglers surveyed said they would not harvest a tiger muskie regardless of the length of the fish, which goes along with the next thing I'll talk about. This leads us, most of the people, you know, who responded don't harvest them. And then we asked what size they considered to be trophy, and it was roughly split into thirds. 30% or 35% said that 40 inches was a trophy. 30% believe that 45 is a trophy, and 31% believe that 50 inches is a trophy. This is kind of perplexing to us, or was. We talked about it at depth and realized that if you combine this with the question above, that all tiger muskie are trophy, regardless of the size, and people don't take them home. Our managers and our biologists in the field have said for years that the most significant form of mortality for tiger muskie is either old age or deep hooking mortality, not taking home. This reaffirms that, which leads us to a conclusion that we need to make some changes. We're going to ask some follow-up questions in the spring. There's a series of directions that we can go depending on public opinion in the spring. So when we do this survey next year, we'll come with a couple recommendations and get people's buy-in or you know, their opinion on whether those are applicable to this management plan. The next question we asked was on our kokanee regulations. And keep in mind, this isn't a reservoir closure. We have possession regulations and closures for the take of tiger or kokanee on many waters. What we want to do is have consistency between waters. We worked with our regional managers to come up with a set of dates that would apply protection to all of the reservoirs in question. So what we came up with was a September 10th through November 30th closure for the possession of all kokanee, regardless of color. Many kokanee in the fall do turn red, but there are some that don't. They turn a darker form of green. So the closure would be to the possession of all kokanee. And 80% of the respondents supported this recommendation. Now, this is a kind of an annual issue that comes up, whether corn should be allowed as a bait in Utah. We wanted to figure out how popular it was with anglers. So we asked, if corn was legal as bait, how many people would use it? 38% of the respondents indicated that they would use corn if it was available. We want better clarity on this. We're not going to move forward with anything, but we would like more clarity on our bait anglers, because this incorporated all the bait anglers and artificial flies and lures anglers together. And so next spring we're going to ask a follow-up question that just asks this question to bait anglers and see how they would respond. Perhaps there's a high proportion of those folks that would like corn. Just for your information, the reason that corn was outlawed in the first place was people used it for chumming. And we talked about that heavily, you know, within the aquatic section. The other thing is it led to littering. People dropped corn cans down the ice hole, which is primarily where corn was used as a bait historically. And so they dropped corn down, which brings the fish in, they used corn and then they were done, and instead of taking an open can of corn home with them, they disposed of it down the hole. And so that's why it was outlawed in the first place. We don't know whether this would, you know, be an impact this time or not, but we're going to look into it. The other side of the aisle, our wildlife folks have a couple of slams that they've implemented, one for waterfowl and then one for upland game. We were just curious whether which species of fish, if we were to implement a slam, would the anglers be most interested in? Just to see where we should start with a slam, because we want to implement a slam on the aquatic side. Basically, what this would be is that on the upland side, if you get a limit of like chucker, quail, cottontail rabbits, or whatever those upland species are, you get a token. And after you get your token filled, that's the slam. And for example, the number one most popular response of what people would support would be the native cutthroat slam. This would be, we have Yellowstone cutthroat, Colorado River cutthroat, Bonneville cutthroat, and that would be a slam if you got a limit of all four of those or went out and caught one of each of those. So if you acquired that, then you would get your cutthroat slam. The native cutthroat slam was the number one most popular choice, followed by a bass slam, and then followed by a pike slam. So we would start at our highest priority, what we figure to be most popular, and then work our way down through time. Okay, that's our surveys. Now getting into the statewide rule changes first. This is in response to that survey question and our desire to standardize our kokanee regulations. So we recommend that we standardize the reservoir kokanee closure to say that it's closed to the possession of kokanee salmon from September 10th through November 30th. Electric Lake Tribs have a possession regulation on it right now. They would fall into this too, so that all kokanee, unless they're otherwise specified, would fall into this regulation. So anything within the reservoir specific section would come out and it would move to the general regulation up front, which would simplify our regulations. In the central region, we have three brand new community fisheries, Pole Canyon Pond in Utah County, Bartholomew Pond in Utah County, and Deer Valley Lakes in Summit County. We have a standardized regulation for all community fisheries. It's just two fish, regardless of species. So these three new community fisheries would fall under that limit. Also in the central region, this has been a contentious issue for years and years as to what is the definition of the ladders at Strawberry Reservoir. Historically, it's dependent upon the water level of the reservoir, and the closure area either expands or contracts and gets confusing to anglers as to what that really means. We worked with the central region folks and our law enforcement folks to clarify what the ladders is, and so it would read, and the Central Utah Project Canal, commonly known as the steps or ladders, would be from the fenced-in upper concrete structure upstream to the tunnel at Highway 40. This would be able to stand the test of time regardless of water levels. If someone is on site, they would know where that is and be able to adhere to the law, which right now we do have an issue with. And it would be closed to fishing. In the northeast region, this is Red Fleet Reservoir, which John alluded to earlier. We had walleye that were illegally introduced into Red Fleet Reservoir about 7 years ago. We have had, up to this point, a catch and kill regulation at Red Fleet Reservoir. We're going to treat that on the 13th of October. What we'd like to do is do away with the catch and kill regulation on walleye, since they wouldn't be there, and then reinstate all of the statewide regulations for all the species that we put back in there. Moving to the southern region, Fish Lake is a new kokanee water. We stocked kokanee salmon in there 2 years ago. Those fish are going to be catchable this year. There are actually a few coming out this last year. As such, we'd like to include kokanee salmon in the general trout regulation, which is a limit of 4 trout or kokanee, regardless of species, which only one may be over 24 inches. So just including kokanee salmon within that regulation to be one of the 4 fish. Okay, Manning Meadow Reservoir. This is a cutthroat trout brood lake in the southern region. They have enough fish in there and have stocked it heavily enough where they believe they can sustain some harvest. They want to have a restrictive limit on it, so it'd be a 2-fish limit, regardless of species, and then artificial flies and lures only, and then have the closure that's there now, which is between January 1 and the second Saturday in July. And believe it or not, that is all. I told you it'd be simple.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any questions or clarifications from the rack? Dan?
Drew, on that survey, we've always had the concern that you might not, all the old retired people who don't have computers may not be able to be involved in that survey. What proportion do we think that might be, the anglers?
We don't know. We honestly don't know. The reason that we use the internet survey is it's the best way that we can reach the most people. There are more formal ways. You're right. The internet probably does skew either one way or the other. Do you remember the 2011 survey, Paul? Because we asked that question, I believe.
Paul Birdsey with the Division of Wildlife Resources. We did capture the age of the people that responded to the survey. I didn't do a formal analysis of the information, but just scanning through, we did see a lot of range, anywhere from about 18 years old up to 65 plus. In the 2011 statewide survey, which was a much more formal survey conducted by Rick Kranick at Utah State University, what we found there was that it was exactly the opposite of what you feel like. There were actually a higher proportion of people 60 years old plus that responded to that survey than are present in the population. So I believe that there's somewhat of a misconception as to the accessibility of these surveys to senior citizens.
I have a question. What's prompted the Kokanee regulation?
Just simplification. We had a number of general regulations. Some of them were September 1st through November 30th, and there was just a whole host that basically were all trying to do the same thing, developed by different regions at different times. And what we wanted to do was standardize, give the protection, but keep it simple for folks.
Other questions? Okay, any questions from the public? Come up and state your name. And
my name's John Schultz, and I'm just curious what prompted the discussion on going back to corn.
Every year that we've done these surveys, it comes up, and there is a segment of our population that wants to use corn. We figured that it was a good time to ask. I mean, every year we have a number of, we have the last question in the survey is a write-in where people can ask anything they want or say anything they want. Some of them aren't worth reading, but that is, you know, and there were a number of folks on there annually that were, you know, curious about corn. From what I've heard, it's one of the best kokanee baits on your behind your Dodger that you can use. I don't know that, but I've heard that.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, any comments from the public concerning the presentation? Okay, don't have any, we'll come back to the rack then, and we'll ask anyone on the rack to make their comments.
Yeah, relative to the corn, you know, as a longtime common carp fisherman, they're kokanee, whatever, there couldn't possibly be a better bait for common carp than corn. And you know, and the chumming is it's still an issue, but I just feel like there might be a compromise. And I know it complicates the regulations, but the use of corn on warm water fisheries where we don't have trout and ice fishing and a lot of that, maybe, I don't know, it might be a compromise. So just, throw that out for food for thought.
Is there any biological data that says corn is, I mean, what is the basis behind not using corn? Is it a myth? Is it a...
There was a study done, and in the wild, there's nothing been done. But there was a clinical study done that looked at trout and their digestion of corn versus other food, and they found that they just didn't digest it well, which reduced their growth and reduced, you know, some other things. And so what it does in the wild, probably minimal, you know, or anything, nothing. You know, it's just a... And we're one of few states that has a prohibition on corn. You know, I mean, not very many people have the prohibition that we have. So, you know, it's more of a social issue. Historically, it's been a littering and a perception issue with people chumming. Those are the reasons that it was outlawed or eliminated.
Anything else from the right?
Yeah, Richard, I'll go ahead and make a motion to accept fishing guidebook and rule amendments as proposed.
Okay, we have a motion. A second?
I'll second it.
Okay, all in favor? All opposed? One abstention? Okay. Okay, got that, Amanda? Okay. Okay, so let's move on then. Hunting technologies discussion. Mitch Lane. Coming.
Good evening. We had a schedule change. I'm not Mitch.
Yeah. Let's try that again. Rick Olson.
Yeah. My name's Rick Olson with the law enforcement section for the division. And I'm going to present a informational only presentation tonight. The purpose of this purpose of this informational item is to look at Western states' regulations in comparison with Utah, to review some technological advances in weapons, and most importantly, to present a survey results of a pretty major survey that we sent out. As I said, this is informational only. There won't be a vote tonight, but we really do need opinions from both the RAC. We have a lot of opinions from the public, as you'll see, but we really want to know what the RAC members think about these things. Every year we get an increasing number of questions from the public, from the legislature, from the RAC and boards on these different types of weapons that are out there and what's available. This last legislative session, there was actually a legislator that ran a bill to allow crossbows during the archery hunts. That bill did not pass, but a promise was made to that legislator that this information would go through the public process again to see what the public wants. Most of these issues have not been looked at for at least 10 to 15 years. And one point I want to make, it's really difficult to compare regulations among states. The biggest reason for that is different states have different hunt structures. So you're not always comparing apples to apples. Okay, the biggest part of this study that we looked at was a hunter survey that went out. Approximately 77,000 2014 deer and elk, general season deer and elk permit holders were surveyed that were at least 18 years of age or older. It was an online survey by email invitation only, so you couldn't just jump on and take it. You had to receive a invitation to take it. It was open from July 27th to August 16th. The respondents only had three choices in answering the questions, a yes, no, or a no opinion. As you'll see, people have an opinion on this. There are very few no opinions. We received 19,000, over 19,000 responses to this survey, the highest number of responses the division has ever received on any survey they've ever sent out. So people are interested in this, and they have an opinion. Now, one of the questions that we asked as part of the survey was, what type of weapon do you normally use to hunt big game? Okay. 47% of the respondents said they use rifles, and the other percentages are there. Now, initially, we thought we would have to present the results of this survey based on weapon preference, meaning that we thought archery hunters would think one way versus muzzleloader hunters would think a different way, and rifle hunters would think a different way as well. In the end, when we looked at that, there was very little difference between the weapon type in the users. So tonight I'm gonna present the combined results, because if you look at each individual weapon, there's really no difference. Okay, the first issue that we looked at was what states allow the use of a draw lock. Okay, three states allow it. This is on a general archery hunt. Three states allow it, 10 do not, 3 are silent, and this is where it becomes really hard. The way the laws are written in some states, if it's silent, means you can use them. In other states, if you're silent, you cannot use them. In Utah, you cannot except with a COR on the general archery hunt. Now you can use a draw lock on any legal weapon hunt. We asked our hunters what they thought. Should draw locks be allowed on bows during the general archery season? Overwhelmingly, our hunters said no. Almost 70%. Okay, the next aspect we looked at was magnifying scopes on bows. 7 states do not allow it. 8 are silent on it. And Utah's a no on that. We asked our hunters what they thought. Again, 70% said they do not want to see magnified scopes on bows during an archery hunt. We also asked them, should range finders that are attached to a bow be allowed during the archery hunt? On this one, the hunters do like that idea. They would like to see the ability to put on a range finder on a bow. Okay, kind of the hot button issue that started us looking into this was crossbows. Okay, on this map, the states in green are the ones that allow crossbows during the archery hunt. The ones in blue do not. In Utah, we are a no, except you can get, if you're a disabled hunter, you can get a COR to use a crossbow during an archery hunt. If you look at the states that do allow it, most of those states are primarily whitetail states, and we're not sure if that's one of the reasons. A lot of the states back east, probably the majority, do allow crossbows, but they hunt really mostly from tree stands, not wide open spaces like it is out here in the west, and a lot of them actually, crossbows are very heavy if you've ever picked up a crossbow. A lot of them have rests on their tree stand that they can just rest that crossbow on, almost like a bench rest sometimes. But they don't have to pack it around the whole time. We ask our hunters, should crossbows be allowed during the general season archery deer hunt? Again, the majority said no. What about the elk hunt? Again, they said no. What about a limited entry hunt for deer, elk, or pronghorn? And again, no. So the public does not want to see crossbows out there on an archery hunt. We also asked the question, if crossbows are allowed during the archery season, should you be allowed to mount a magnifying scope on it? And even a greater percentage said no to that, which that kind of presents a problem, because most manufacturers of crossbows, they come with a scope, and they're kind of built into the crossbow. It's difficult. You can't just undo a couple of screws and take it off. Okay, on to muzzleloaders. We looked at the states that do allow a magnifying scope during a muzzleloader-only season. Again, in Utah, we don't, but you can put a magnifying scope on a muzzleloader and use it on any weapon hunt. But 10 states say no, 7 allow them. We asked our hunters what they thought. Should magnifying scopes on muzzleloaders be allowed during a muzzleloader season? The majority said yes. So for some reason, they don't want scopes on a bow, but they do want scopes on a muzzleloader. I think we may have an aging population that needs better eyesight, like me. Okay, moving on to rifles. We looked at minimum calibers. 7 states have no minimum caliber. 4 states require 22 or larger. 5 states, 24 or larger. In Utah, we're more simple. We just go with must be center fire and an expanding bullet. Now, we did not ask a question to the public on minimum calibers, because we very seldom ever get that question from the public. Most hunters want to make a clean, ethical shot. They don't want to shoot something with a 22. If they shoot them with a 22, they're usually at night, and we deal with them a different way. Okay, we looked at maximum calibers, though. There's only 2 states that regulate the maximum caliber. North Dakota has a maximum caliber of 49, so they outlaw the 50s. Idaho attempted to do this by weight of the gun. I'm not sure why they did that. And if we ever tried to regulate something like this, please don't make our officers carry around a scale and have to weigh a gun. It's a lot easier to do it by caliber than weight of a gun. We ask our hunters what they thought about the large caliber. Over 70% said no, they don't want hunters using those large calibers. Okay. The next question we asked, should hunters be allowed to use rifle-mounted range-finding scopes? Now, these are scopes that do not shoot out a beam of light. They would be illegal, but just a range-finding scope. And currently, that is legal in Utah, and the hunters want it to remain legal, according to the survey. Okay, we looked at some really cool new technology. I'm not sure it's hunting technology, but it is weapon technology. If any of you guys, are you familiar with a smart gun? Basically, what a smart gun does is the computer-aided aiming device attached to the gun, integral with the gun, and at some point, you have to put a red dot or crosshairs on your target. But when that dot or crosshairs are on that target, you don't pull the trigger. You push a little button, it's called tagging it. After the target's been tagged, you just point the gun at the target and it will fire on its own when it's right. You never miss. It's pretty impressive. If you go to the website and Google trackingpoint.com, you can see some demos on this. We ask our hunters what they thought about allowing smart guns to hunt with. As you can see, they absolutely do not want to allow these smart guns. Okay. So in summary of the survey, The public, they do not support the use of crossbows. They do support rangefinders on a bow. They support variable scopes on muzzleloaders, and they do not support large calibers or smart guns in the use of hunting. Now, in Utah, if we had to change any regulations to match up with the survey, the only things we would have to change would be allow a rangefinder attached to a bow, allow magnified scopes on muzzleloaders, and then outlaw large calibers and outlaw smart guns. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Let's bring it to the rack. Go ahead, Ben.
I'll start with just a couple questions. On your slide about the powered scopes and muzzleloaders, there was a comment on there that I noticed that said something about with a COR, which I'm not familiar with. Can you explain that?
A COR on a muzzleloader? Yes. If your eyesight is, I can't remember the exact, worse than 40-40 or, I know if you're legally blind, which people can still see that are legally blind, mm-hmm. you can get a COR to put a scope on a muzzleloader or on a crossbow for a disabled person. But
okay.
That's the only way.
Aware of that, so good to know. And then on the rangefinder attached to a bow, I remember vaguely when that law was put into place, Bushnell put out a rangefinder that attached to a bow, and it was shortly thereafter that was outlawed, and I believe it was outlawed in quite a few states. What I don't remember is why. Can you clarify?
I'm not sure either. Okay. I never have been able to answer that question very easy in the field when you check a hunter when they're holding a bow and they go, this is okay, but this isn't.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, did you want to stick to questions for now or comments?
Let's just talk about it, and then we'll find out if the public has any other comments.
Okay.
Any other questions? Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, this doesn't relate to any of that, but it's consistent with the with what you're trying to accomplish here. While I was in graduate school back in the Southeast, Louisiana and I think Alabama and several other states were using poison pods on their arrows, and I've never really heard any reason why that is not wouldn't work here. People say, "Oh, yeah, just shoot farther," and shoot. But when they studied that, they found that the hunters were not really doing that, but that their recovery rate was much higher, and plus there wasn't the issues with the public seeing critters running around. Arrows sticking out of them because the blood toxin would put the animal down, relatively efficiently. Well, what do you know about any of that?
I don't really know anything about that specific topic. I do know that there's a lot of other issues with weapon technology than what we discussed here. It's too big of an issue to deal with all at one time. We needed to break it up in chunks. When you send surveys out, history's shown us that if you ask 20 to 30 questions, the public won't take it. It takes too long. They'll open it up, look, that takes too long, and they won't take the survey. If you want good results, you have to ask less questions. So, we didn't look at a myriad of other, arrow weight versus arrow lengths, or broadhead size, or electronic ignition on muzzleloaders, or there's all kinds of other issues that we can look at later.
Hey, I have a couple of questions. What's the effective range of a crossbow? Does it depend on what type of crossbow it is?
It is. It's pretty much the data shows that a crossbow, they'll shoot the same distance about. They'll come out a little bit faster other than the brand new up-to-date bow. Ben could talk about that probably more than I could. But they lose their energy quicker because the bolt or the arrow is lighter. So they might shoot just as far, but they're probably not going to be as lethal at say, 60 yards as a traditional bow is.
Aren't those bolts a little bit smaller, too, shorter?
Yeah, they're shorter.
And then survey that you did you keep, is there any place on there that you knew whether or not they were a dedicated hunter in the dedicated hunter program?
No, we did not ask that.
Because, they're going to hunt with they could hunt with archery and all rifle.
They're right. If a dedicated hunter got one of these, he would have had to choose which weapon. You know, he had one question, which weapon do you predominantly hunt with? If it was, 30-30-30, split in thirds, I'm not sure how they would answer, but we didn't look at that. We didn't try to break that out.
Okay, and then on the caliber question, would you be inclined to recommend different caliber, minimum caliber sizes for deer versus elk?
Well, we're not recommending anything at this
stage. I know,
thing.
I'm just wondering just, down the road.
So I couldn't really answer that. Our plan for this is to, we've got pretty much at least what 19,000 members of the hunting public think. Now we're looking, what do the RAC members think? What do the Wildlife Board? Well, we'll get to the, well, this will go to the Wildlife Board. What do they think? And then the division will go back and we'll come up with any recommended changes in the November meeting. They'll be run through the RAC meetings in November and then the board meeting, which I believe is 1st of December.
Yeah.
Just a question. Putting a scope on the muzzleloader for the muzzleloader hunt, were you thinking of any power scope or were you thinking of limiting the power?
We didn't. We just asked a question about a variable power scope. I mean, currently you can only put a one power scope on. Now, I don't know, when I look through a one-power scope, the target looks smaller to me.
It is.
Than if I just looked with the naked eye. I'm sure an ophthalmologist could tell you. I'm not sure what. I think you would have to have about a two-power scope to be equal with a naked eye, but that's just me talking.
You're right.
But no, we didn't, we haven't looked at should it be limited to a four-power scope or should it be a 3x9 or a 12 or a 20 power? We didn't ask that question.
Comment. I was just going to say the fact is that last year, I appreciate you giving me that excuse for why I missed my deer with the one power scope on my muzzleloader. I thought it looked pretty small as well. But just as a commentary, I think it's pretty evident that most of our hunting public wants to keep our hunting pure and fair chase, and giving everybody the opportunity as well as the opportunity for the animal to escape and elude you, then to turn around and put themselves in a situation that's an automatic. I think the lure of hunting to a certain degree is the satisfaction of putting the efforts in, going out in nature and using your skills and honing your skills in to become a better hunter. And I think your survey actually addresses that pretty well on the answers that you received. Just a comment.
We were a little surprised at some of the results. A lot of it, I was not surprised about the variable scopes on a muzzleloader, for example, because when you work in the field checking hunters, that was a common theme that you heard time and time again. Why can't I use a scope so I could see better? I could make cleaner kills if I had a scope.
Let's ask the public if they have any comments.
About the caliber of the bullet. Consider asking the question not the caliber of the bullet, but the weight of the bullet, the grain of the bullet?
No, we just looked at caliber. We didn't look at a weight or grain or any of that stuff.
One of the issues I have is the, like a 22 caliber bullet, they make heavier grain bullets in a 22 caliber bullet, which are very effective. If you get a 50 grain Spitzer out there, it's just actually just going to splatter on an elk. It's not even going to penetrate it. And that's one of my issues.
We didn't ask a question related to that, but like I said, there's a lot of other things, we could ask about round ball versus Sabbath. We had to take off one chunk at a time to look at this.
Okay. Let's, let's go to the public and ask them if there's any comments out there concerning this. Questions? Questions about his presentation?
What would you got? Where do you want me to start? Which weapon?
If you've got a question about the presentation, we can
What's
do that.
That. Oh, come on, sir.
Awesome. Just state your name. And
you bet. My name is Kelly Hicks, and I'm just representing those people in Utah that help with the crossbow. And I know for a fact, Ben Lauder sat next to me and Director Sheehan at the Senate hearing earlier in the spring. I currently hunt with a crossbow. I do have a COR due to bad shoulders and some other things. Some of the things that were presented here may or may not be 100% accurate. Maybe one of the answer to Ben's question, or somebody asked it, the difference between a crossbow and a vertical bow. There's a ton of difference between the two. A crossbow, yes, it absolutely is faster right off the bat. I mean, you can buy crossbows now that shoot 400 feet a second right off the bat. They do shoot an arrow that's 22 inches long, but because of its size and its length, it loses its effective kinetic energy a lot quicker than a bow does. There's not a manufacturer made. Now, the point was made also that crossbows all come with a scope. They're all pretty much all a three-power scope right now. There's only one manufacturer that makes even a sight that you can look through that looks something like what a vertical bow has. But the effective range on those scopes is only 80 yards. The maximum you can get with one today is 80 yards from the manufacturer. And that is a single-pin type scope that you dial to the range, and so you're set at that point. All the others are basically a three-power scope. And you're right. When you look through a one-power scope, you're seeing half of what you typically see with your eyesight. You look down at a muzzle loader, and what you see the barrel, don't you? Yeah, it's horrible. It's not worth even having. Either not have it or do have it. Crossbows, are they effective? I think they're very effective in certain situations. He mentioned that back east, a lot of people use them because, one, they're sitting in a tree stand where there's very little movement, or they're sitting in a ground blind. Again, very little movement. They're ready for the animal to come in. If you are, I've carried mine now for 2 years. If you're walking around these hills, there's nothing easy with carrying a crossbow. I think the fear the public has is that we're going to put the crossbow in people's hands and they're going to kill everything they see. But I guarantee you that's not the case. They're like, you might as well carry a boat anchor on your back because that's what it feels like. They are heavy. I think mine weighs probably about 12 pounds altogether. What does a vertical bow weigh? Chris, your bow probably weighs what? 7.5, 8 pounds? Maybe. I love the vertical bow world. I don't think there's any chance that the two are going to meet. I think once somebody picks those things up, they're going to say, wow, this is not for me. They're very difficult. Yeah, in certain situations, very effective. But certain situations. I hunt the Wasatch Front a lot. You can't walk through this oak brush with a crossbow loaded. There's no way. You're going to lose your arrow or something. I walk around with mine. I do walk around with mine cocked. And I have a dry fire mechanism in it that allows it so it won't, even if something hits a trigger, it won't go off. But then when I'm ready to hunt, I'm pretty much sitting down, or I mostly hunt out of tree stands because of that. They're not, I mean, they're great weapons. People are not going to go out there and kill more animals. The effective range, I guarantee, I know archers right now that have sights on their bows that can shoot up to 140 yards, and they take those shots, and they kill animals. At 60-plus yards, I have to just sit there and watch. There's nothing I can do. I have no mechanism that tells me where that arrow is going to end up. And I'm not going to try and shoot at something and guess. So I just let it go. I've done it many times. So I am a proponent, and I think crossbows have a place. I think they're like today, anybody can hunt with a crossbow on the turkey hunt. Is it a perfect hunt for turkeys? Absolutely. Somebody could take their kids and take them hunting, sit in the ground blind, and wait for those turkeys to come and kill one. perfect example for use of a crossbow. Could somebody's little kid use one? Absolutely. Could the kid carry pull a bow back? Maybe not. Probably not. Because what? We can hunt when you're 9 years old, right? You can kill a turkey when you're 9 years old. Those kids are not going to kill a turkey with a vertical bow. But with a crossbow, they might. So we might get more people into the hunting market that are not there today. Ben, what do you think about all the things I've just said? And you were there that day, so I know you have comments.
I have strong opinions about the crossbows, and there's a number of other things I'd like to comment on. So, Mr. Chairman, whenever it's appropriate, I'll make those comments.
Questions from the audience.
Any questions on crossbows?
Any questions?
Crossbows, no.
Questions from the audience?
And I'd be happy to chat with you more.
No, absolutely. I mean, they're hard. They're very hard to hunt with.
And I will give my comments here for the division as well. So.
Now, we've kind of spilled over into the comment sections, but there anyone else in the public who would like to give comments on the presentation? Come up to the mic, state your name.
I'm Travis Ritzman. I came mainly over the issue of putting scopes on muzzleloaders. I really appreciated the comments that came over from over here about honing your skills, about learning the game and getting close. When I took up muzzleloader hunting, at the time it was considered to be a primitive weapon, and it's evolved considerably over the years. After I took the survey and I voted against magnifying scopes, and then when the results came out, I looked that up and saw that the majority of Utahns, and I suspected that would be the case, and so I got on my cell phone here, and it took me about 2 minutes to find a video of a guy shooting an antelope at 715 yards with a muzzleloader. And I've got a good buddy that's a proponent of the scopes. Had the argument several times. If you have the scope, you can shoot more accurately, you can harvest game more cleanly. My argument is if you have the scopes, you're going to extend the range. That shot that used to be 150 yards maximum, it is now 300 yards, 400 yards. Like I said, I found that video. It took me a couple more minutes to find an advertisement for a company that advertises, what's their slogan? Put them in a pile from a quarter of a mile, 500-yard muzzleloader. To me, that really just takes away from, we've got a season where we can use rifles with scopes. For people that want to go out the day before and take a few shots at a target and be able to have some chance of harvesting their game. And I think we need to keep the seasons for the rest of those of us who like a little bit of solitude and who like to challenge ourselves. And so those are my feelings on the matter. I probably won't get far, and I can guarantee you if it's approved, I'll probably be one of the first guys to go out and buy a scope, because I'm losing my sight, but I would like to see it stay as it is.
Question for him. So you'd like to see it stay the way it is?
Yes.
Would you be objected to, say, a 4-power or less? Or would you say just plain leave it alone?
I like it the way it is. That's my opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments from the public? Bring it back to the rack, then. What have we got that you'd like to talk about this? Ken?
Well, my big concern about all of this is, are we going to have primitive weapon hunts, or are we just going to let them evolve into what they're starting to evolve into now? As far as a muzzleloader, I would never like to see it go above 4-power, and if it stayed where it was, that wouldn't hurt my feelings, because that's always been set as a primitive weapon. Same with the archery. It's always been a primitive weapon, although the bows that we have nowadays are starting to change that drastically. But I think we just need to sit down and think, are we going to keep it as primitive weapons, or are we going to go ahead and change into the modern day and see what happens? I know in Colorado, if you hunt with a muzzleloader, you still use flintlocks. So just go from there.
Anyone else?
All right. I'd like to address a couple of these survey questions individually, one at a time. First, I'll discuss both kind of in combination crossbows and draw locks. Currently, they're legal during the any weapon hunt. They're legal with a medical exception during the archery hunt. In short, personally, I feel that we have the right combination of laws as it is right now, where if you want to hunt with a crossbow and you don't have a medical exception, you have that option during the any weapon hunt. And then during the archery hunt, if you want archery hunt and you have a medical exception that allows you to hunt with a crossbow or a draw lock, that option is there as well for those who need it. I would like to make a distinction between hunting with a crossbow and hunting with a vertical bow. I don't discount at all the effectiveness of a crossbow and their ability to take an animal cleanly. And I don't have any problems with that. Where I make the distinction between a crossbow and a vertical bow as far as archery bow hunting goes is the movement and that's required in order to shoot a vertical bow. And this really comes into play heavily when you're hunting an animal like elk, where typically you're calling them in and they're coming into you, it's close range, they're approaching you. With a vertical bow, you have that movement of drawing the bow, and that is a key element to shooting a vertical bow. And I can personally tell you that makes a difference. I have had elk that with a crossbow would have been a slam dunk because I'd have just been set up waiting for them. With a vertical bow, when I tried to draw, they blew out of there. Also, the holding weight of the vertical bow. Very similarly, if with a crossbow, you can set up and wait. With a vertical bow, it will fatigue you over time if you're holding that a full draw. So those are the two, I think, very important distinctions between a vertical bow and a crossbow. And personally, I like the laws the way they are now concerning both the crossbows and the draw locks. And if you'd like to discuss this more afterwards, I'd be more than willing to discuss it with you one-on-one. So I guess in summary, I agree with the survey results there. Rangefinders attached to a bow, kind of indifferent on that. I guess I don't really have an opinion one way or another there. The smart guns, I've looked at the Tracking Point Rifles website. Incredible technology, fascinating technology. Awesome for military and law enforcement purposes, but I don't believe they have a place in hunting. And then finally, the scopes on the muzzleloader. I'm kind of torn on that one as well. As we start putting powered scopes on muzzleloaders, it feels like we're turning that into a single-shot rifle hunt. And it is getting away from the primitiveness of it. I hear the arguments both ways. As a gentleman mentioned earlier, if that law were to change, I'd be one of the first to go out and buy a scope with whatever maximum power would be allowed by law and with turrets. And to that point, you are extending the range at that point when you start putting powered scopes on muzzleloaders. That pretty much wraps up what I have to say. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Just a couple on the muzzleloaders. I could live with the way it is or up to four. Just like that, I think I higher than four, I would probably oppose. With crossbows, why I've always felt that it was better in the any weapon hunts is this is the first time I've heard somebody carrying a crossbow cocked and not loaded. Everybody else I've talked to, you're cocked, you're loaded. It's not the mechanism of an arrow hitting an animal that separates the two. It's the fact that you're carrying a loaded weapon, that you raise it like a rifle and you fire it like a rifle, rather than the vertical bow, which you have to in the presence of the animal very close, have the movement of drawing, supporting that by your own muscles. So the shot of a crossbow to me is more similar to a firearm than a vertical bow. That's why I would support the separating and the survey.
I just need to make a correction. Sometimes my brain and my mouth don't mix. I mentioned dry lock. I meant flint lock on the muzzle loaders.
Dan?
Yeah, I you know, having spent too many years in college, this survey is extremely, highly significant. I mean, I'm going to support the public on all of the things that they think is right.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So I've been on a few committees and had this discussion with numerous folks, and it generally, from my perspective, comes down to two different issues. Talk about generally comes down to wounding rates and success rates. And I think we have to be really clear with the public the best that we can with each of these different technologies, what impacts it'll have. I think the public, in my opinion, is going to be generally accepting of something that's going to help us more cleanly harvest an animal, but we have to be aware of success rates. If success rates goes up, it means tags have to go down. And that, you know, we talk about ethical hunting, we talk about, you know, a pile from a quarter mile, we talk about those different things. I think we have to be very cognizant of that. And that's my biggest concern. I don't have an issue with muzzleloader scopes other than, does it increase my odds of success? Because if it does, in 2 or 3 years, less people get to hunt with the muzzleloader because success rates go up. And that's my biggest concern. And I think if we can approach these different technologies from those perspectives and clearly understand what the impacts are going to be, whether that be with studies or whatever information we have, I think that helps a lot of people make a decision on some of these issues. You know, does a vertical bow versus a crossbow increase archery success rates? I think a lot of people would like to know that, and I'm sure there's some strong opinions already in this room, but I would like to know that. How much does it increase success rates by? Might not increase your yardage, but do I have less blown stocks and I can, you know, kill more deer? Because we know as archery hunters, we can get within your range often, but the motion of drawing a bow blows a lot of those stocks. Does a crossbow impact that? I would like to know those types of things. And same, the difference between a 1 power and a 4 power on a muzzleloader. Does that change your success rates? And for me, that's a determining factor in being able to make that decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, again, and I agree with everything you said, Marvel. But the one thing that I learned while I was back east is that, as was indicated out here, there's a huge difference between spot and stock or whatever, and shooting from a blind or a tree stand. And I think what you'd see if we started liberalizing those, you know, a crossbow, is you'd see a migration to more blind hunting and more tree stand hunting. And I'm addicted to tree stand hunting. It's just so much different, so much fun. So I don't know. I think you're right, though. In evolution and the approach to hunting in the West here, springs and funnels and that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Okay, I have a couple of questions. Do we even attempt to get some kind of data on wounding rates? Do we do that? I mean, is it even possible? I mean, do we do a survey that would somehow you could extrapolate information that says, you know, I killed or I shot a deer or I shot an elk, it got away? Do we have any of that information?
can answer that. Because they do randomly select calls to the public and ask them, did you hunt in your unit? And one of the questions is, did you wound any animals? I'm pretty sure most people are going to say no because they don't want to be, they don't know. I'm pretty sure most people will say no, that they didn't wound anything.
Okay, is there an acceptable rate of wounding animals and not, you know, harvesting them? Is that put into how we determine permit numbers and tag numbers and that sort of thing? Not right now? Okay.
And on the mule deer survey, didn't we have some wounding rates from the survey itself, at least for mule deer?
It seemed like we did. Types. Yeah. And I guess we just have to trust that the public's, you know, being legit with their answers, you know, on that. I just wonder that, muzzleloaders, for an example, when I first started hunting with muzzleloaders, I had to put that cap, pull that back and put the cap on and try to shoot, and sometimes it didn't shoot. You know, now the inlines have made that, and so rifle and muzzleloaders have come closer together and their ability for use to harvest. I see that in the advancement of bows. It's unbelievable. I mean, I started out with a recurve that I made in a high school shot. Now my boys have got, you know, the compound bows, and they've got trigger mechanisms they put on there. And, I mean, it's pretty amazing stuff. So it seems like to me, instead of keeping them as primitive weapons, we're getting a little closer to rifles all the time. And so I think it's important that the board think about, you know, where do we want to be? I mean, and then also weigh out the whether or not this thing that Chris was talking about, you know, wounding, or are you more efficient, or are you less efficient, and what's acceptable, you know, socially in that way. So I would encourage all of you to think about these things, because I think they're looking for some direction and some focus on some of this stuff, and what the board has opinion-wise with these things makes a difference, and they'll formulate something, I'm sure, that we'll be able to look at and decide whether or not we agree with that or not. Large caliber rifles, over 50 and over, I think, personally, I think should not be allowed, you know. There's a big push about that, you know, and that's a kind of a feather in your hat. If you can kill a deer at 1,200 yards, you know, with a 50 caliber gun, you know, okay. But is that what we want hunting to become, you know? So anyway, is there any other questions, comments from the board?
I guess this isn't an action item, right? So you're there asking for opinion. Well, my opinion is exactly what the public says, so there you go.
Okay, I think we've discussed it enough. Think about it. We can talk about it further. Okay, with that, I think we're done. Thank you for coming. We'll see what the board decides on this. Thank you.
Like my shirt?
Yeah, we need a motion to adjourn here. If we want. Okay, we'll do that. We'll all second that. Okay.